Chapter 7, The Mystery of Human Communication. What can possibly follow Vimalakirti's thunder-like silence? One might think that almost anything, however sublime, however impressive, would be an anticlimax. But as it turns out, it is not really so difficult to follow, not at least for Shariputra. At the beginning of chapter 10, we find him worrying again. The text says, "Thereupon the Venerable Shariputra thought to himself, 'If these great bodhisattvas do not adjourn before noontime, when are they going to eat?' A short while ago he was worrying about chairs, now he is worrying about lunch. But why is he so concerned that they should eat before noon?" Well, Shariputra is a monk, and according to the Hinayana Vinaya, the monastic law, monks are supposed to finish eating by noon. If they haven't managed to have a meal by then, they just have to wait until the following morning. Even then, they're not permitted to eat until they can clearly distinguish the lines on their own hand by means of natural light. This rule is still observed in many parts of the Buddhist world. I followed it myself for several years when I lived in India, and there's quite a lot I could say about what some monks used rather irreverently to call the 12 o'clock business. Monks are generally dependent for food on the laity. I often noticed that if lunch had not made its appearance by 11:30 a.m. or even 10:30, some of my fellow monks became very uneasy. A few started worrying about lunch as soon as breakfast was over, and some would get up at the crack of dawn so they could have an enormous breakfast, then go back to bed and have a second breakfast later and still have time for lunch before 12 o'clock. In a famous passage, Buddha Ghosha declares that someone is a one-mealer even if they eat 10 meals, provided they eat them all before noon. This is the Theravada at its most ridiculously formalistic. What I do take seriously is the principle of moderation in eating, and you could practice this by eating only in the evening as effectively as by eating only in the morning. The Sufis apparently try to observe a perpetual Ramadan, eating only after dark. But you could eat 10 times a day and still be practicing moderate eating, if you ate just a small quantity. The important thing is to eat mindfully, and eat only what is really necessary for health and strength. It is a good thing to have a definite framework of behaviour, definite guidelines, especially when one is young, and it is even a good thing to be quite strict in observing those guidelines. An old Brahmin lawyer I used to know in India, a very rigid, orthodox old man, was fond of saying, "A disciplined life gives strength," and this is true. In the case of this old man, he derived his strength from following the Brahminical rules, with some of which I would violently disagree because they involved the strict observance of the caste system. But they did make him into a very strong character, because he believed that he was following a divinely inspired way of life. But following a system of discipline doesn't necessarily have any spiritual value at all. You develop a kind of strength in the army, in which you are governed by a certain ethos and have to observe certain rules. And even the so-called rules of Buddhism, the guidelines which you find in the traditional Vinaya Pitaka, are not necessarily helpful to us now. The principle behind all of them is probably still valid, but it may require a different application, a different expression. It might be a useful exercise to go through all the Vinaya rules systematically, examining each rule to see what principle is involved, how it was applied or formulated in the Buddha's day, and whether the formulation still applies, and if not, what fresh formulation of that principle might be helpful. Some Theravadins would argue that one should continue to observe the rules out of faith in the Buddha. This sort of attitude cannot be disregarded altogether, but one could argue that it could not be the result of faith, because the Buddha encourages followers to think for themselves. The value of observing rules is not to be underestimated, but one has to give careful thought to what rules one does observe and why. One should not be inflexible about it. It's no good trying to defend the Vinaya rules by saying, if it was good enough for the Buddha, it's good enough for me. We shouldn't just accept the tradition unthinkingly. It's a question of finding a middle way. You can't go it alone, relying on a one-sided individualistic way on your own judgment, your own opinion. You need to consult with those who are wiser and more experienced than yourself. On the other hand, you don't want to submit unquestioningly to authority. It is not easy to follow this middle path, but we have to try. There has to be a place for faith, and there has to be a place for healthy scepticism. It is very easy to go from one extreme to the other, rather than searching for the middle way. But if we are going to accept some authority unquestioningly, why bother with Buddhism? Why not just go and join the Catholic Church, which is so much closer to us in culture? Why give ourselves the trouble of going to the East and setting up an infallible authority there? And on the other hand, if you're going to be a thoroughgoing sceptic, why bother with Buddhism at all? Go and be a humanist. Go and be an agnostic. Buddhism is a middle way between the extreme of authoritarianism and the extreme of individualistic thinking for oneself. Whether or not Shariputra is going to extremes, here we find him getting sidetracked once again. And once again Vimalakirti takes him to task. He knows what Shariputra is thinking, of course, and he says, Reverend Shariputra, the Tathagata has taught the 8 liberations. You should concentrate on those liberations, listening to the Dharma with a mind free of preoccupations with material things. Just wait a minute, Reverend Shariputra, and you will eat such food as you have never before tasted. Vimalakirti then puts himself into a state of deep concentration and exerts his magical power. As a result, the whole assembly is enabled to see a far distant Buddha land. There are, as we have seen, an infinite number of Buddha lands, or pure lands, each with its own characteristics. And here, in chapter 10, the feast brought by the emanated incarnation, we find ourselves introduced to another one. Like so many places and people in the Buddhist scriptures, it has a rather long name, Sarvaganda Suganda, which means sweetly fragrant with all fragrances, or sweetly perfumed with all perfumes, and is to be found in the zenith, the upward direction, infinitely distant from our own wretched, impure Buddha land. The text says that it is beyond as many Buddha fields as there are sands in 42 Ganges rivers. That kind of distance takes quite a bit of imagining. This Buddha land is presided over by the Buddha Sugandakuta, which means heap of fragrance or mountain of perfume. The trees emit a wonderful fragrance, which we are told far surpasses all the fragrances, human and divine, of all the Buddha fields of the 10 directions. Even the names of Arhant and Pratyeka Buddha are unheard of here. The Buddha Sugandakuta teaches the Dharma to an assembly consisting exclusively of bodhisattvas. All the houses, the avenues, the parks, and the palaces are made not of brick and stone, not of marble, not even of jewels, as they often are in the Mahayana Sutras, but of perfume. And the fragrance of the food eaten by the bodhisattvas in that pure land pervades and permeates innumerable universes. So, through Vimalakirti's magical power, the whole assembly is enabled to see, or rather experience, This pure land, Sarva Ganda Suganda, which consists entirely of perfumes. And, just at the moment that it is revealed to them, the Buddha Suganda Kuta and his bodhisattvas sit down to a meal. Apparently it is lunchtime there too. The meal is served by a class of deities called Gandabiuhahara, or gloriously perfumed, all of whom are devoted to the Mahayana. Vimalakirti asks the assembly gathered in his invisible house if anyone would like to go to that Buddha land and bring back some food. But rather strangely, nobody is willing to go. The reason is that they have all been restrained from offering to make the journey by the supernatural power of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom. Luke's translation here is, "All the Bodhisattvas remained silent as Manjushri was noted for his supernatural power," while according to Thurman, no one volunteered because they were restrained by Manjushri's magical power. And Lamotte says, "Through the supernatural intervention, Adhisthana of Manjushri, all the Bodhisattvas kept silent." It seems quite clear that the original must be because of Manjushri's supernatural power. One translator takes that to mean that Manjushri actually intervened with his supernatural power, while the other interprets it that Manjushri had the reputation of possessing such power. Incidentally, Lamotte's assertion that Manjushri's supernatural intervention, as he renders it, is equivalent to Adhisthana is not quite right. It is more like the Sanskrit Riddhi, or supernatural power. The point here is that Manjushri wants to give Vimalakirti an opportunity to show what he is capable of. He doesn't want the other bodhisattvas present to make an exhibition of their own blundering efforts to go to this other Buddha land, so he prevents them from volunteering so that they can see what Vimalakirti can do. This seems to me to be the sense of the text. If Manjushri is restraining the bodhisattvas in some way, it can only be as a skillful means. It cannot be for any selfish motive. Vimalakirti obligingly takes this opportunity to perform a magical feat. By means of his magical power, he emanates an incarnation bodhisattva of youthful appearance, adorned with all sorts of auspicious signs and marks, and so beautiful that he outshines the whole assembly. Vimalakirti directs the emanated incarnation to go to the pure land sweetly perfumed with all perfumes and bow down before the Buddha Suganda Kuta, and say that Vimalakirti asks for the remains of his meal, because with those remains, Vimalakirti will accomplish the Buddha work in the universe called Saha. Saha, or suffering or tribulation, is of course our own world. And so the emanated incarnation goes to that distant Buddha land, is given the food in a perfumed vessel, and in a fraction of a second returns with it to Vimalakirti. And that is not all he returns with. He is accompanied by 90 million bodhisattvas, who have all been given leave to come by Suganda Kuta. Vimalakirti, of course, makes room for all of them in his house. This time he doesn't bother bringing in any more thrones from elsewhere. He just creates them out of thin air. The fragrance of the food brought back spreads throughout the entire great city of Vaishali and beyond, spreads in fact throughout 100 universes. Noticing the fragrance of this wonderful perfume, everybody in Vaishali is amazed and filled with joy and elation. They feel purified by the perfume, cleansed in body and mind. And they all come flocking to Vimalakirti's house, where they too sit down, all 84,000 of them. The gods too, we are told, are attracted by the perfume, and they also turn up at Vimalakirti's house. And everybody in this now truly vast assembly is then given a portion of the food to eat. as he distributes the food, Vimalakirti says, "Reverends, eat of the food of the Tathagata. It is ambrosia perfumed by the great compassion. But do not fix your minds in narrow-minded attitudes, lest you are unable to receive its gift." Once everybody has been fed, so many tens of millions of beings, there is just as much food as before. And, having eaten, everybody present is completely satisfied. They all experience a deep spiritual bliss, and a wonderful perfume emanates from the pores of their skin. Vimalakirti then asks the bodhisattvas who have recently arrived how the Buddha, Sugandhakuta, teaches his Dharma. They tell him, "The Tathagata, the Buddha of that Buddha land, does not teach the Dharma by means of sound and language. He teaches the bodhisattvas only by means of perfumes. At the foot of each perfume tree sits a bodhisattva, and the trees emit perfumes like this one. From the moment they smell that perfume, the bodhisattvas attain the concentration called source of all bodhisattva virtues. From the moment they attain that concentration, all the bodhisattva virtues are produced in them." The bodhisattvas then return Vimalakirti's question, asking him how the Buddha Shakyamuni, our Buddha, teaches the Dharma in our world. And Vimalakirti replies, "Good sirs, these living beings here are hard to discipline. Therefore he teaches them with discourses appropriate for the disciplining of the wild and uncivilized. How does he discipline the wild and uncivilized? What discourses are appropriate? Here they are. This is hell. This is the animal world. This is the world of the Lord of Death. These are the adversities. These are the rebirths with crippled faculties. These are physical misdeeds, and these are the retributions for physical misdeeds. These are verbal misdeeds, and these are the retributions for verbal misdeeds. These are mental misdeeds, and these are the retributions for mental misdeeds. This is killing. This is stealing. This is sexual misconduct. This is lying. This is backbiting. This is harsh speech. This is frivolous speech. This is covetousness. This is malice. This is false view. These are their retributions. This is miserliness, and this is its effect. This is immorality. This is hatred. This is sloth. This is the fruit of sloth. This is false wisdom, and this is the fruit of false wisdom. These are the transgressions of the precepts. This is the vow of personal liberation. This should be done, and that should not be done. This is proper, and that should be abandoned. This is an obscuration, and that is without obscuration. This is sin, and that rises above sin. This is the path, and that is the wrong path. This is virtue, and that is evil. This is blameworthy, and that is blameless. This is defiled, and that is immaculate. This is mundane, and that is transcendental. This is compounded, and that is uncompounded. This is passion, and that is purification. This is life, and that is liberation. Thus, by means of these varied explanations of the Dharma, the Buddha trains the minds of those living beings, who are just like wild horses. Just as wild horses or wild elephants will not be tamed unless the goad pierces them to the marrow, so living beings who are wild and hard to civilize are disciplined only by means of discourses about all kinds of miseries. Most of this is quite straightforward, not to say blunt. There is just one aspect of it that may require a little explanation. Vimalakirti says that the Buddha teaches that this is false wisdom, and this is the fruit of false wisdom. False wisdom is a very misleading translation, making it sound as though there are two kinds of wisdom, one false, one true, and one false. The Sanskrit word here is dauspranya, and this corresponds to the Pali Dupanya, a term which occurs several times in the Dhammapada and is usually translated evil understanding. One could say that Dupanya and Michaditti, false view, are roughly synonymous, but the Michaditti is a much more precise technical term. A Michaditti is a certain definite point of view which is wrong. Dupanya is just the general state of having an evil or wrong understanding, an understanding clouded by unskillful mental factors. One could say that Michaditti is Dupanya articulated into specific philosophical positions which are mistaken. So Pranya is being used here in its more general sense of understanding. Pranya in the highest sense could not possibly be false. Conditions in this very impure Buddha land are such, Vimalakirti says, that bodhisattvas who work here have to have very strong compassion and determination, much stronger in fact than that of bodhisattvas in Buddha lands such as Sava Ganda Suganda. Such bodhisattvas accomplish therefore correspondingly greater benefits for living beings. Then, after a few more exchanges between the visiting bodhisattvas and Vimalakirti about the practices and qualities that a bodhisattva in this Buddha land needs, the chapter ends. There is a great deal that could be said about all these incidents and the figures involved in them. By this I do not mean that there are a lot of specific points that could be made in the ordinary discursive way. It is more that if you allow your mind to dwell upon this particular episode, a number of different facets and aspects of its significance disclose themselves. You can investigate, for instance, why the emanation bodhisattva bows down when he arrives in that other pure land. Why does Vimalakirti ask for the remains of a meal? And why does Sugandakuta comply with his request? What does the meal itself signify? What does the ambrosia, or amrita, the nectar of immortality of which the food consists, represent? Is there some meaningful connection to be made between the vessel in which the food is contained and the Holy Grail? And why is the food it contains not depleted, even though millions of beings have been fed? There is plenty of scope for imaginative reflection here. We will focus, however, on just one topic. We have heard that the Tathagata Sugandakuta teaches his dharma, disciplines the bodhisattvas, not through sound and language, but through perfumes. Perfumes are his medium of communication. This may seem to us very bizarre, but what a nice way of being disciplined. Like the other physical senses, the sense consciousness of smell arises through the contact of sense organ and sense object. But in the case of the sense of smell, rather curiously, there is less direct contact between the two than there is between the eye and shapes and colours, or the ear and sounds. In the case of the sense of smell, there is a kind of intermediary. A rose in a distant garden emits millions of tiny invisible particles. Some of them enter our nostrils and come into contact with the olfactory nerve endings, and we smell the rose. Scent, or perfume, is an extremely subtle thing. We can't see it, we can't hear it, but it is very definitely there. Almost everybody can distinguish a good smell from a bad smell, a perfume from a stink. But smell very often affects us on an almost unconscious level, and can therefore be used to create a mood or feeling. This has led to the manufacture of all sorts of artificial odours which are used in various ways. They are used in social life when we want to make ourselves more attractive, or at least less offensive, to other people. They are also used in religious life to create a particular kind of atmosphere. Many religions, for example, use particular kinds of incense in connection with certain ceremonies and observances, which suggests a definite connection between certain odours and certain mental and emotional states. The sense of smell is the least well developed of all our senses. In this respect, we are very different from certain other animals. In dogs, for instance, the sense of smell is very highly developed, more so indeed than their other senses. It is said that dogs experience, and therefore live in, quite a different world from human beings, a world of odours. When the dog puts its nose outside the door, it experiences hundreds of different smells coming from all directions, all quite vivid and distinct one from another, and all meaning something. Some human beings, of course, have a more acute sense of smell than others, but certainly not as acute as that of dogs and other animals. Perfume can therefore be said to be a symbol for something very subtle and delicate, something that is quite intangible, yet definitely there. Something that can be perceived and that can have certain effects on us, even from a distance. According to the Mahayana, the subtlest of all influences is the influence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the influence of enlightenment, the influence of great compassion. It is not easily perceived, yet in a sense it is always present, like radio waves in the air. Great compassion is not just an individual emotion at however high a level. It is a transcendental emanation of reality itself, of the reality with which the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are at one. In the mythic language of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, this reality is amrita, which literally means deathless. It is what the Greeks called ambrosia, the nectar of immortality. And this ambrosia is perfumed. Vimalakirti says to Shariputra and the great disciples, "Reverends, eat of the food of the Tathagata. It is ambrosia perfumed by the great compassion. In the pure land, sweetly perfumed with all perfumes, Sugandhakuta and the Bodhisattvas regularly feast on this ambrosia. They feast on reality, they are nourished by it, and they are therefore pervaded by its influence, by the perfume of compassion. In fact, the whole of that pure land is pervaded by it. Everything there is made of it, made of compassion. In that universe, all the houses, the avenues, the parks, and the palaces are made of various perfumes. It is a universe of purely spiritual, purely transcendental influences. Power in the sense of force does not exist there in however subtle a form. In this way we may descry something of the meaning of what is going on when Vimalakirti has the ambrosia brought from Sugandhakuta's pure land, when its fragrance pervades the entire great city of Vaishali, and when it permeates and pervades 100 universes. And we can begin to see the nature of its effect on the people of Vaishali and the gods and goddesses. We find the same symbolism in an important and historically influential text of Far Eastern Buddhism, The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. Mahayana here refers not just to a particular form of Buddhism. It means something like great principle. This work is not a sutra. It is not represented as being a discourse by the Buddha, but a shastra, a text attributed to a great Buddhist teacher, in this case, Asvaghosa. It survives only in Chinese translation, and according to some scholars, it was actually composed in China. It speaks of ultimate reality as tatata or buddha tatata. Tatata means simply suchness. Buddha tatata means the suchness of things. Ultimate reality is such as it is. It cannot be described. If you ask what reality is, the only possible answer is that it is such as it is. All that you can say about reality is that it is characterized by suchness, or such as it isness. This ultimate reality is spoken of in the Awakening of Faith and the Mahayana as perfuming conditioned existence. Something of reality rubs off, so to speak, onto conditioned existence. A few infinitesimally tiny particles are transmitted, and we can therefore perceive ultimate reality, however faintly, in the midst of conditioned existence. And, perceiving it, we can strive towards it. Not only does ultimate reality perfume conditioned existence. According to the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana, conditioned existence perfumes, if that is the right word, ultimate reality. And ultimate reality's response is to manifest compassion. This is a very profound conception, but it gives us some idea of the appropriateness of perfume as a symbol for great compassion, whose influence is so very subtle and delicate. Practicing meditation gives one at least a limited sense of this kind of influence. A time comes when you begin to sense something which you cannot describe or define. It doesn't come under any mundane category, yet at the same time there is nothing vague or cloudy about it. It is intensely vivid, intensely real, like the perfume of some unknown flower. We might say that it is the perfume of the thousand-petaled lotus itself, the lotus that blooms in the pure land. Two things follow from the fact that we can have this kind of experience. First, just as we can perceive odours only because we have a sense of smell and the nose, in the same way we can perceive the subtle perfume of ultimate reality only because we have within us a kind of transcendental sense, something that has an affinity with the transcendental, something to which the particles of the transcendental can be transmitted. This is what the Mahayana, in a general way, calls the Tathagata Dhatu, the element of Buddhahood. Secondly, this transcendental sense of ours can be developed, can be made more sensitive and more refined, to the extent that, eventually, it can tell us where the perfume is coming from and from which direction we have to take to find its source. We have seen that in the Buddha land called sweetly perfumed with all perfumes, Sugandhakuta communicates the Dharma by means of perfume. This is not really such a strange idea as it first may seem. In fact, we know from our own experience that perfume or odour is a means of communication. Everything and every place has its own distinctive odour. When I visited New Zealand, for example, I noticed the distinctive spicy smell of the countryside, the bush, very sweet, yet at the same time sharp and refreshing, even stimulating, and very different from anything that one can experience in England. People also have an odour. Here we begin to tread on rather delicate ground. This is something that we are not supposed to talk about. A person's odour is not just due to hygiene and cosmetics. It is affected, for instance, by the type of food you eat. A vegetarian smells quite different from a meat eater. My vegetarian friends in India say that sometimes they cannot bear being too near Westerners because of the smell. The smell, they believe, of the meat they have eaten. Women smell different from men. Children smell different from adults. And very young people smell different from very old people. People who come from one part of the world smell different from people who come from another. Dogs can recognize these distinctive natural odors, but most humans cannot, although they can certainly develop the capacity, and some so-called primitive peoples have it, at least to some extent. It seems quite likely that all human beings originally had this power, but most of us have subsequently lost it, especially once we started living in settled communities, away from such close contact with nature. But one smell which many people can still recognise is what we might call the smell of death. When someone is dying of illness or old age, They give off a distinctive smell which can be perceived even by people whose sense of smell has been blunted by civilized living. Smell has its part to play in communication. The most important factor in any communication is the emotional state of the people engaged in it. And emotional states produce all sorts of physical reactions, including glandular secretions, which each have their own odour. We speak, for instance, of the smell of fear, or the smell of anxiety. We do not often have occasion to speak about the odours of more positive emotions, probably because they are less powerfully and pungently developed. It is, however, well known that a perfume similar to that of roses or jasmine is sometimes perceived in a room where someone is meditating, not only by the meditator, but also by other people present. Whether or not we are conscious of it, smell is very much part of our response to other people. So, although we tend to assume that communication is possible only through words, we should not really be surprised to learn that in the Buddha land of Sugandhakuta, perfume is the means for communicating the Dharma. Of course, we may object that rarefied communication by perfume is all very well between Buddhas and Bodhisattvas at a transcendental level, but has little relevance to what goes on between ordinary human beings. But Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are human beings too. They may be enlightened, or partially enlightened, but their communication, however rarefied, is still a form of human communication, and as such it can be developed by us too. The important point is that words and language are not the only medium of communication. Many others are possible. We find this emphasized in the next chapter of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, chapter 11, which is called Lesson of the Destructible and the Indestructible. At the beginning of this chapter, there is a change of scene. We are no longer in the vast, throne-filled mansion that Vimalakirti's house has by now become, but back in Amrapali's park with the Buddha, who is teaching the Dharma to the rest of the assembly. And as he teaches, the park becomes larger and larger. Not only that, the entire assembly is suffused with a beautiful golden light. Ananda is rather surprised by this and asks the Buddha what it may mean. The Buddha replies that it means that Vimalakirti and Manjushri are on their way with a great multitude, and a few seconds later they all arrive. In fact, Vimalakirti magically transports the entire assembly, thrones and all, on the palm of his right hand. When they have arrived, saluted the Buddha and taken their thrones, Ananda remarks on the strong scent of perfume which suddenly pervades the air. The Buddha tells him that it is emanating from the pores of all the Bodhisattvas. Shariputra hastens to add that it is emanating from the pores of the Arhants too, and he explains to Ananda how it has come about. After exchanging a few remarks with Vimalakirti about the perfume and the food, and about how the perfume emanates from the bodies of all who have partaken of this food, Ananda then says to the Buddha, "Lord, it is wonderful that this food accomplishes the work of the Buddha." And in a very important passage, the Buddha replies, "So it is, Ananda. It is as you say, Ananda. There are Buddha fields that accomplish the Buddha work by means of bodhisattvas. Those that do so by means of lights. Those that do so by means of the tree of enlightenment. Those that do so by means of the physical beauty and the marks of the Tathagata. Those that do so by means of religious robes. Those that do so by means of food. Those that do so by means of water. Those that do so by means of gardens. Those that do so by means of palaces. Those that do so by means of mansions. Those that do so by means of magical incarnations. those that do so by means of empty space, those that do so by means of lights in the sky. Why is it so, Ananda? Because, by these various means, living beings become disciplined. Similarly, Ananda, there are Buddha fields that accomplish the Buddha work by means of teaching living beings words, definitions, and examples, such as dreams, images, the reflection of the moon in water, echoes, illusions, and mirages. And those that accomplish the Buddha work by making words understandable. Also, Ananda, there are utterly pure Buddha fields that accomplish the Buddha work for living beings without speech, by silence, inexpressibility, and unteachability. Ananda, among all the activities, enjoyments, and practices of the Buddhas, there are none that do not accomplish the Buddha work, because all discipline living beings. Finally, Ananda, the Buddhas accomplish the Buddha work by means of the four Maras and all the 84,000 types of passion that afflict living beings. In this passage, the Buddha goes much further than we have gone so far. He says that there are many alternative means of communication, many means to accomplish the Buddha work, to teach the Dharma. It is possible, he says, to communicate by means of bodhisattvas. Perhaps Vimalakirti did this when he sent the golden emanation bodhisattva to visit Sugandhakuta. Vimalakirti has also communicated by various other means, through the food that was brought back, and through silence. It is also possible, the Buddha says, to communicate by means of the Bodhi tree. This makes me think of examples of early Indian Buddhist art, which do not represent the human figure of the Buddha, but just show the Bodhi tree as a symbol of the Buddha's presence. And there is even the possibility, apparently, of communicating by means of lights in the sky. Naturally, some people will take this to be a reference to UFOs, which are said to be an attempt on the part of extraterrestrial beings to communicate with people on Earth. Be that as it may, we do need to be reminded of these alternative means of communication, because we tend to depend too much on words and language. This tendency is perhaps not quite so pronounced in Asia and Africa as it is in the West. Only too often we feel that we have not really expressed ourselves unless we have put it all down, put it all into words, unless we have spelt everything out in full verbal detail. Educated people are particularly prone to this. Of course, we have already seen how important it is for the Bodhisattva to express himself clearly and correctly. We need to be articulate. But we should not think that when we have put something into words, whatever it is, has necessarily been fully expressed. There are different, there are alternative ways of communicating. In fact, we do not rely entirely on words, even though we may think we do. When you compare a written transcription of a seminar with a tape recording, for example, the written version seems to have a dimension missing. Listening to the tape, you hear not only the words, but also the way in which they were used, the tone, the pace, the pitch, and the volume, all of which contribute to what the speakers wanted to say. If the seminar was videotaped, you would get an even better impression of what the participants wanted to communicate, because you would have not only words and sounds, but also gestures, expressions, and so on. In the Buddhist scriptures, of course, we have only the words of the Buddha. Something of the context is often given, but we do not have his tone of voice, or the look with which he said something. We do not have the Buddha himself saying it. We have only the words, and this surely makes a big difference. In exploring alternative means of communication, we are not simply seeking to exchange one means for another. Different means of communication allow us to communicate different things. It has been said that when we learn a new language, we acquire a new soul. It is certainly true that we can say things that we could not say before, as I know from my own experience. There are some things I can say in Hindi that I can't say in English. The words may be translatable, but somehow they fail to convey the entire meaning, all the nuances and connotations. And some languages are more suitable for certain purposes than others. When asked what language he usually spoke, Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor of the 16th century, replied that when he spoke with his courtiers, he spoke in French. When he spoke to his mistress, he spoke in Italian. When he spoke to God, that is, when he said his prayers, he spoke in Spanish. And when he spoke to his horse, he spoke in German. The same applies to alternative means of communication. With them we can say things that we could not say before. It is not simply that they enable us to say the same things in a different way. With them we can say different things. It's like having an additional sense through which more of the universe is revealed. It is well known that our physical perceptions are very limited. The eye perceives only a certain spectrum of colours. The ear perceives only a narrow range of sounds, and the nose perceives only a very few odours. The same applies to our mental perceptions, the perceptions of our ordinary conscious mind. They too are very limited, and in any case they function entirely within the distorting overall framework of the subject-object relationship. It is important, therefore, that we acquire new senses and new means of communication. The more means of communication we have at our disposal, the better. So, let us learn to communicate in terms of perfumes. Let us learn to communicate in terms of silence. Let us learn to communicate in terms of lights in the sky. It is important that we very much enlarge the total range of our being and consciousness. The mystery of human communication is perhaps even greater than we had supposed.